welcome to edition 379 of the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck, and Tom Edwards.
On the show today, we'll be speaking to artists Langlands and Bell, the Turner Prize-nominated duo whose admiration for one of London's most influential city planners, Frank Pick, has inspired their new installation.
We'll also be hearing from musician Will Carruthers, a man who can lay claim to appearing in some of the most out there psychedelic records of the past 30 years. And he'll be in here on the show later.
Plus, we'll get a lesson in branding from Michael Johnson, the designer whose works appeared everywhere from Virgin Atlantic to the Science Museum. He'll be talking through his new book, Branding in 5.5 Steps, later in the show.
All that, plus Monocle's Henry Rhys Sheridan's own personal brand, will be firmly demoted to the bargain bin in the news look ahead. And we'll play some music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Andrew Tuck, what a week it's been. It's noon, it's Sunday, it's the Monocle Weekly, edition 379, and good to be here. What a show in prospect today.
I'm really looking forward to it. It's been quite a weird week. I had a day in Dubai. That was really good. Went to Dubai for a distribution event and to meet lots of nice readers, which I did on Tuesday. And I haven't quite known where I've been since then.
No,
I've been racing to catch up. When you have 3 days out of the office with travel and events, you come back and you never kind of get on top of that. Everyone else is ahead of you the whole week.
Well, it's very dense, a couple of days. And
yes,
of course, it's been, you know, we're talking about art later in the show, and it's been, you know, Freeze, London is in session. There's been quite a kind of arts vibe about quite a lot of what's been going on. And we did some shows, some great shows actually, from over at the fair.
Yeah,
in the park as well.
It's finishing today, of course, but I went over to Freeze a couple of times during the week, and I like all the artwork, so I just like seeing the crowd. Millionaire old hipsters. Like, more crazy suits and weird haircuts than you've ever seen, and I love it.
It's good. It's good. It's good for people watching.
Yes.
Without question. Speaking of people watching, shall we see what Henry Rhys Sheridan is clad in this Sunday lunchtime?
Let's drag him in.
Henry, oh Henry, love the way you jump and rock.
All right.
Henry, oh Henry, love the way Texas is hop.
But how am I doing now?
Everything is all right.
And here is Henry Rhys Sheridan. We were very mean about your brand at the top of the show. What do you think your personal brand is?
I would not like to speculate. I don't think my place to speculate on what a personal brand
is. So you wouldn't go with Andrew's bargain bucket assertion?
I found that hurtful.
It's friendly, Henry. Friendly banter.
Yeah, I think...
Bargain bin banter.
Bargain bin, yeah.
Reliable. I think your brand would be reliable.
Thank you very much. That's not very sexy, though, is it? That's not going to sell.
What about sexy reliable?
That sells tools. Do you know what I mean? What's marketed as reliable, which you actually want?
Reliably sexy.
Reliable.
How about that?
Is that a contradiction?
You're the Black & Decker drill of the journalism world.
Thanks, Andrew.
Well, that's kind of sexy and reliable.
But a Makita drill, that nice teal colour. You know what I'm talking about. I used to love walking around that part of home base when I was a kid.
I think we should get stuck into the week ahead.
On the 10th of October, I didn't know this, Canada is celebrating its very own Thanksgiving Day. Do you know about this?
Of course I do.
Go on.
It's their version of Thanksgiving.
On the 31st of January 1957, the Governor General of Canada issued a proclamation, very old-fashioned, stating a day of general thanksgiving to Almighty God for the bountiful harvest in which Canada has been blessed, debatable, to be observed on the second Monday in October. Bit too general for me. Do you know what I mean? Because in the American one, it's like a gift between... There's some interaction between the Native Americans and the European settlers. That's just a bit...
And a turkey.
And a turkey, indeed. Yeah.
Do you know what they eat for Thanksgiving Day in Canada?
I think there are pumpkins. Because I think it actually, in terms of culinary traditions...
This is going to change people's weeks. I think there are pumpkins.
I think there are turkeys. I think it's combined with the Northern European general festival of harvest.
Okay.
Which, you know, when you were at school and you collected all the cans and, yeah.
It's a good moment to reflect on the bounties that Canada has to offer around the globe.
You're very right, Henry. It was about collecting all the cans. But isn't it sad that that's what Harvest Festival came down to, collecting all the cans to give to, like, the local grannies, but anyway.
Yeah.
I remember. Is that a worldwide thing, or was that just in this country?
I think that's Northern Europe.
Is it?
Yeah, I think it is Northern Europe, yeah. Another thing, which is, though, Tom, very specific to this country, I've learned through talking with my international friends, the World Conquer Championships.
Love it.
which is taking place in Northamptonshire. Now,
home I think of Monocle's own Josh Fenner.
Today, indeed, on the 9th of October. Is it? Interesting.
Yeah. Big cobbler, Josh Fenner.
The 52nd World Conquer Championships take place at the Shuckburgh Arms in Southwick, near Oundle, in Northamptonshire. I think I'm pronouncing all those place names right.
Oh, incorrectly, but it's fine.
Around 500 competitors. Oh, sorry, I take back what I said earlier. Apparently from many countries, but I don't think it's very widespread out there.
Do you think children still play with Conkers?
I understood that health and safety meant that it was being banned.
Because
they had to wear protective eyewear or something.
On a Sunday, when I go through Regent's Park with dog, there is amazing horse chestnut trees. That's the right one, isn't it?
I believe so, yeah.
That's correct, yeah.
Okay, so all the Conkers are just lying there on the floor.
Kids aren't gathering them in.
No one's gathering them.
That's a big thing in my school days as well.
Yeah, when I was a kid, it was like, where is the Conker tree? Whacking logs up into the tree to try and dislodge them. Bashing each other's wrists to pieces with bits of Conker.
Taking someone's eye out.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
I wonder if it's health and safety gone mad. Is that why? You're not allowed to do it anymore.
It's probably on an app now, isn't it?
Exactly. It's probably digital. There's probably digital Conkers. They probably play it on an app. That's depressing, isn't it? What were your favourite tips for hardening them up?
Vinegar? You're supposed to soak them in vinegar.
Bake them. Wasn't it one? Put them in the oven?
Well, I wasn't allowed to put it in the oven, but vinegar was mooted to be the way to kind of victory.
Did that work? I don't know. I don't remember.
One of my peers, who will remain nameless, in Newton Primary School in Swansea in the 90s, actually wrapped his conker in sellotape, mummifying it, and thought that was a legitimate technique. That's quite outrageous, isn't it? Imagine if someone came at you with
it. Was it covered in sellotape?
Completely mummified in sellotape, and then he started going at other people's conkers with it.
I think that's cheating.
That's definitely not in the spirit of it. It's against the
spirit. What happens to the winner up in Northamptonshire? Do they get a trophy or, we don't know, cash prize?
It's charitable, Tom. The event takes place on the second Sunday of October every year. The club has raised well over £400,000 for the blind and visually handicapped in its history, which is fantastic. I know what you're thinking.
I did say
it is coincidence.
Were any of them blinded or handicapped before the game?
That's just paying off people who brought lawsuits.
There's a circularity, to that whole process, cause and effect, if you will. I feel we should move on.
On the very provincial, I'm sorry, it's a very parochial news look ahead this week. British Egg Week begins.
Okay. I love eggs.
Tomorrow. It has the theme, put an egg on it, and is set to encourage customers to experiment with eating eggs.
Put an egg on
more
what?
Unusual ways, Tom. I'll give you a recommendation. Crack an egg on the pizza before you put it in the oven. Seriously.
Well, you see those.
Egg on a pizza.
I thought that was a hot tip, but apparently I'm behind the times.
I don't know if they do that in Italy, though, do they?
I'm not sure.
I think they would think that was sacrilegious.
Probably.
Put an egg on it. Is that like put a ring on it?
I don't know. I mean, it clearly is modelled off that. Same sentence structure. There's a statement structure. But you know there's a big difference. We actually have very... I think it was you that was telling me this. We actually have very high standards of egg, or at least good standards of egg preservation in this country. In America, you're legally obliged to refrigerate eggs, which you don't need to do. It's a massive... in supermarkets, it's a massive waste of energy. And also, they chemically wash their eggs, which actually removes a membrane, a very thin membrane, microscopic membrane.
It's more likely
on the outside of the shell. Exactly.
To get cross-contamination.
Precisely.
I am a big fan of the old ad campaign, Go to Work on an Egg. Do you remember that one, Andrew?
I do.
From the 60s,
one, that's one of those apocryphal stories, it turns out, that everybody wrote it, isn't it? Wasn't it Salman Rushdie wrote it? Really? I want to find out.
Did that happen? Yeah. Go to work. I do go to work on an egg. Not literally. I have two boiled eggs every morning. Two bits of toast, invariably.
Well, apparently, they used to say you shouldn't eat that many boiled eggs. Is it because they're high in cholesterol? But actually, you can literally eat as many eggs as you want.
Do you know how many eggs Margaret Thatcher ate while she was in office per day? Six. That's a bit of trivia for you.
Is that... Yeah, but That would suggest to me that you'd probably best avoiding eating half a dozen eggs then.
Well, you know.
Again, what came first?
Or at least opening the window of an afternoon.
In the cabinet.
Okay, anything else or are you done?
Anything else, that's it. I thought that was quite good. Good
Henry,
and all this week.
Put an egg on it.
We start today's show in London, a city whose design legacy has been shaped by bold personalities, big ideas, and some less celebrated but nevertheless brilliant minds who make it all work together. Frank Pick was a man who understood the link between design and function only too well, one of the shaping forces behind London transport for much of the 20th century. He oversaw everything from branding to station design. Though many of his ideas are now considered blueprints for success, his philosophy always remained simple. The test of the goodness of a thing is its fitness for use, he once says. If it fails on the first test, no amount of ornamentation or finish will make it any better. It will only make it more expensive and more foolish.
Now, two artists with a similarly useful-minded approach, Ben Langlands and Nikki Bell, are commemorating Frank Pick's work with a new installation, Beauty, Immortality, set to feature at London's Piccadilly Station. Langlands Bell's work spreads from film and digital media projects to sculpture, installation and full-scale architecture, and it's earned them a Turner Prize nomination too. And they join us now to discuss that upcoming project and more. Welcome to the Monocle Weekly. Let's start with the new commission, this work about Frank Pick. So extraordinary that the London Underground, it's great that they are thinking like this. They came to you and asked you to think about his work and make a commission. How did the story begin?
Yes, they did. I think it originated partly with the... In 2013, it was the 150th anniversary of the Tube and the first underground railway trains running. And so I think they got to thinking about, you know, the whole legacy of transport and the integrated transport system that London has. And the man who was really, you know, who had the kind of vision and imagination and drive to see that that is what London needed, an integrated system, was Frank Pick. But nobody really knows who he is. I mean, even Harry Beck, who designed the map, who worked with Pick, is reasonably well known now. And the map, of course, has become a sort of internationally recognised icon. But Beck was actually fostered by Pick, and Pick was responsible for many other aspects of what we recognise today and what's known all over the world as, you know, symbols of London, like the underground roundel, the map, and, of course, the Johnson type font and Holden station design. So they really wanted to celebrate this legacy and the man who was responsible for putting it all together.
Nikki, could you just tell us what the actual work is? So it picks up on the notion of the station signs, correctly?
Well, we're using a combination of materials here. We're going to be using bronze, enamel, LEDs. We want to actually bring his actual name, Frank Pick, to the core. So he will be incorporated in a roundel itself to commemorate him. And we're using the words that we discovered when we went to Acton. And the words are...
Beauty, immortality, utility, perfection, goodness, righteousness, truth and wisdom. The funny thing was that we discovered these words written like a little scientific equation almost in the margin of some of his lecture notes. And they'd been sort of almost, you know, they'd been sitting there for 100 years unnoticed. The lecture notes were actually, he'd prepared for a speech he was giving to the Art Workers Guild in 1917. As soon as we saw this little equation written in the margin, we recognised that he was struggling with what good design is, how we recognise it and what it means to us. And in our view, we thought, we saw that he was trying to trace the path of everyday qualities to kind of universal values, if you like. Pick was actually a lay preacher. He was a very kind of spiritual man, but in a very kind of pragmatic way. And he was always wrestling with, you know, as you've already pointed out, that things should be really useful, they should be unadorned, and they should get right to the heart of things, and that anything else would be basically frippery and unnecessary. So in this little equation, you get the essence of the man struggling with his beliefs and how to implement them.
And also, it's wonderful to give him back his own voice, give him back the very words that he wrote down and his beliefs.
There is something, there's a sort of a beautiful, I don't know, simplicity almost, and yet complexity at once with that list of words. Nikki, let me ask you a little bit more about the underground, because a lot of these the infrastructure, a lot of the things that were associated with Frank Pick, as you mentioned, have not been forgotten, but they're sort of passed by. And there's a great beauty, there's an extraordinary design quality in so many of the stations, so much of the design of it all. Are we all guilty, do you think, particularly if we're Londoners, of slightly passing these things by? You know, day to day, we don't look around and see often very beautiful things that are in front of us.
Yes, I think this is the case. And I think this memorial, I hope, will go a small way to allow people to stop and think, who was Frank Pick? We're saying Frank Pick for Piccadilly. You know, we're trying to bring his name to the public awareness. And I think, you know, you can nudge people in that direction by doing a beautiful memorial using his own words and philosophy.
Now, Ben, much of your work has been involved with our kind of relationship with architecture and the built environment. Is this one of the reasons this project appealed to you? Because it's a kind of nice marrying of the design world of architecture and of, as you say, the people who go through Piccadilly every day, the thousands and thousands of people who go through there every day. There's an extraordinary moment they'll have of relationship with your artwork.
Yes, I mean, you know, we're really privileged to have had this opportunity. You know, we do feel very fortunate. Yeah, actually, we're both Londoners and we grew up in London using the underground and the buses. So we were very kind of familiar with it. And then we realised that this was an opportunity to really understand it, consider it at a deeper level.
Yes, I mean, he was an amazing utopian and he was also a polymath. So through art, design, engineering and architecture, he was able to reach so many levels.
Okay, well, we've managed to nab you on what will be the closing day this Sunday of Frieze here in London. You've had an extraordinary and amazing career. Just reading some of the things that reminding myself of some of the things you've done before we came on the show today. When you look back to the start that you got and the way that your careers began, even like the studio space that was available in London back then, do you kind of look at the art world now and wonder whether you would be able to have the same journey if you were starting out today?
I think we'd have a different journey. I think, you know, there are no rules. And one of the things is, I mean, we fully recognise that London's become an incredibly expensive city. And when we started out in the 70s, there were whole streets of derelict and abandoned buildings. And that was, on the one hand, you know, it was easier to find studio space in more central areas of London and it was cheaper. But also those buildings for us became a kind of subject in themselves as well. So there were very rich opportunities, but I'm sure there are rich opportunities now. I wouldn't want to try and play down for a second how difficult things are made by things being so expensive. But, you know, artists are used to thinking differently and to working in different ways and developing new opportunities. I mean, that's the job of art. So I wouldn't want to write us off just yet. Although I don't want to write off.
It's just interesting you that when you started, you know, you had, I wonder, even if today someone did a show like Sensation, would it have the same impact? Would a man like Charles Saatchi be able to have the same impact in an art market now where there are 1,000 Charles Saatchis? And it's interesting how, you know, all of our careers, you know, we've all depended on somebody giving us a bit of luck along the way. I wonder if those are more complicated moments to find in the city.
You know, it's true that the kind of art world is always expanding. You know, it's a bit like the universe. You know, it's always moving outwards in different directions.
There are now hundreds of galleries. When we started out, you could count them on your hand. There was sort of the Liston Gallery, the Dofay Gallery, Maureen Paley. There were very few. And now, you know, we have a proliferation of galleries.
Really good galleries. So it's...
Yes, so the whole landscape has changed.
It'll probably be something else that changes it. You know, I mean, Charles Saatchi did have an incredible effect. But
also his wife Doris did. Let's not forget Doris. Doris Saatchi was a huge influence and a great eye behind Charles. And I think she needs to be recognised too.
I want to ask you briefly, we talked about the proliferation of galleries and I guess in the sort of digital world that we're in now, there's so much access. People are familiar with so many more artists than they would have been before. You both, obviously, so many of your commissions are for public spaces. They're quite high profile. Is there something then that's enduringly attractive about doing work on that scale and for public spaces in particular? Because it's not about people who are interested seeking it out. You're right there, you're right amongst people. And there's an exposure to so many more interested eyes. Is that one of the reasons why those sorts of projects remain so interesting for you?
It is. I mean, we're interested in the relationships between people at every level. So whether it's, you know, our own sort of personal relationship, working together for almost 40 years, or relationships, you know, within the art world or at the level of the city or between countries and cultures. You know, we're interested in all of these relationships, and, you know, we see anything where these relationships are manifest as communication, whether it's architecture or air routes and aviation systems or the internet. These, for us, are very kind of interesting, fertile ground for us in terms of our work. And we're so fascinated by these things, and also we find them so beautiful. That's why we love making work about them. And that's also one of the things that appeals to us about working in spaces where there are, you know, there is more open access or public access. And so you can engage with people and you can explore those relationships in a different way, at a different level.
I presume that many of the things you're doing, the scale and the commitment, that these are not, you know, I know that many of you do editions and many things do end up with, you know, private collectors as well. But is there something about the nature of your work that you need to have support from big institutions and people who can give you can literally the space to kind of show what you're capable of?
I think we work in lots of different ways. And, you know, we're lucky to have had support from, you know, very wide range of people, whether it be somebody like, say, Maureen Paley when she first started her gallery in the mid-80s and showing with her as a young artist.
In her house. Or she had a gallery in her house at that time in Beck Road. Yeah.
So. Or showing with Charles Saatchi in the first Young British Artist
And that
exhibition.
Space was incredible in Boundary Road. I mean, that was an eye-opening space. I mean, for us was one of the most exciting spaces we'd ever shown in.
Or, you know, being nominated for the Turner Prize or being commissioned as artists to go to Afghanistan to research the conflict there. It's challenges that provide opportunities that, you know, these are the things that excite us and allow us to make new work.
Because there is, you know, between Frank Pick and Osama bin Laden, you must be the only two people who have a kind of direct route in responding to Osama bin Laden's house in Jalalabad. And also responding to Frank Pick's work on the underground. That's one stop on the art underground for the two of you. It's an amazing connection. But
transport is something that, you know, we are very involved in, because it does take you to all the other places that you wish to visit and inform what you do.
Transport systems are, you know, communication, you know,
and exchange.
May manifest, don't they?
It's wonderful to hear from you both, and we're very excited to see the project as it unfolds. Ben Langlands and Nikki Bell, thanks so much for coming to see us on the Monocle Weekly and telling us all about the latest commission and your previous works. Thanks for being here.
Thanks
very much.
Andrew, I think time for a tune now.
In
a moment, we'll be hearing from Will Carruthers, the journeyman musician who spent time in some of the most notorious psychedelic bands of the past few years, but maybe miraculously lived to tell the tale. Let's hear a little of his work. From 1991, this is Spaceman 3 with I Love You.
Well, that was Spaceman 3 featuring Will Carruthers with I Love You. That was the song. I wasn't talking to you, Tom. And we'll be hearing from Will in just a moment.
Will Carruthers is a musician who served on the front line of rock and roll, playing with some of the most deranged psychedelic bands of the past 30 years, among them British acts Spaceman 3 and Spiritualized, two groups known for a somewhat intimate relationship with musical excess, both on and off stage. And he's also been a member of notorious San Francisco via Berlin outfit, the Brian Jonestown Massacre.
He's somehow still around to tell the tale, and he's written a book about it all. His memoir, Playing the Bass with Three Left Hands, is available now. And Monocle's Tom Hall sat down with him a little bit earlier to hear more about it.
It was a dreadful compulsion and a sickening addiction that led me to seek gratification through music by travelling the terrible highways of the country and eating in grot holes and playing to unappreciative dogs in the corner of desolate wastelands.
And it was quite fun.
And it was fun as well, yeah, do you know?
Yeah.
It was not as much fun as I thought it was going to be. Or it was a different kind of fun, which is perhaps the best fun in that.
I was interested in the chapter simply named Suicide, because, mm-hmm. I mean, there's any number of connotations with that word, but obviously one is the song that you guys played, and then there's also the band. But I liked the fact that you were saying that sometimes that song could go on for 10, or it could go on for 20, or it could go on for a time period where time seemed to cease to exist. I've seen the Brian Jonestown Massacre play with you in it, and I think I've seen their song Swallowtail go on for like 30 minutes at least once. That's quite a feat. And also in that sort of chapter, you sort of say how like the experience of playing it was not enjoyable because it was actually like it's a physical feat. You've got to have like a sort of vice-like hand to be playing that long.
There's a certain amount of endurance involved, certainly in playing a bass anyway, but in playing long repetitive songs. It's funny you mentioned Swallowtail, because most of the other members of the Jonestown, with the exception of Anton, were always like, oh God, it's Swallowtail. And it was always at the end of the set when you were tired and you're like, right, let's get ready for the final. And it goes on for, you know, interminable length.
It's amazing that me and my friend were just aghast. It's almost like an athletic feat, but it's also like a sort of weird fuck you to the audience, as in like you're not leaving.
Suicide was definitely a bit of that. We played a show in Switzerland, I think, and towards the end of the set, the back of the room began to fill with people who were ready for the post-gig disco, the apres. Après Peace Disco, mating rituals, and we were churning out Suicide. And we could see him at the back of the room looking unnerved. So we went off and then we came back on and did it again for another 20 minutes just to piss him off. It was, I mean, there's an element of bloody-mindedness about it. But, you know, you've got a slog to transcend, haven't you?
It's a journey, I guess.
It's a bit of a slog transcendence sometimes.
Do you think that with the sort of growth of digital music and technology-based music, there is a slight disconnection? You know, people can say they're committed to music, but if you're so committed to it that your hand actually feels like it's going to fall off, that is a different kind of commitment, isn't it? Like, do you think that physical action of being involved in music is sort of, I'm not saying it will disappear, because there's a million ways you can physically connect to music. You can just dance to it, it's fine. But it's like, do you think that with, you know, just a guy like nodding to a sampler on stage, do you think that that is the same kind of performance as a band who are almost sort of collapsing because they can barely get through the song?
So does it have to be, how physical does it have to be?
Yeah, basically.
I guess it depends how good the person nodding along with a sampler is and how good the band are, you know?
Yeah.
I think it's, you know, people always make music if it's just like banging on a cardboard box, do you know, or singing. Do you know how much effort is involved in singing?
Yeah.
And I think whatever you're doing, if you're deeply involved in it, it's going to take some energy from somewhere. And that physical energy is not all it takes.
Yeah.
I couldn't tell you what the thing is that it takes to do it. I'm still trying to work that out. I've just written a book about it and I still don't know. In fact, I wrote the book and I was like, why do I do this? Somebody said, why do you do it? And I said, I'm not sure why I do it, but I'm mostly glad I do.
Yeah.
So, you know, digital, analog, you know, I'm no Puritan about these things. I think if it sounds good, it doesn't fucking matter.
I saw a video of you online making a book from scratch.
I'm a book binder.
Yeah, I'm assuming you didn't bind every single copy of the new one.
The Faber edition, I didn't. Faber very kindly allowed me to bind some books at home because I'd written a couple of books and I made editions of 100 on my kitchen table. So they're allowing me to continue that because it keeps me out of the bars. It keeps me out of trouble and it seems like a reasonable pastime for an aging rocker.
But that is a kind of, that's a very, very niche skill. How did you get into learning to do that? What was the impetus behind you learning that?
I'd had a terrible Icelandic wrestling incident at the end of a tour with a band called Dead Skeletons, who are an Icelandic Tibetan death mantra band. It's highly unlikely. I have no idea how I ended up in that band. But at the end of a very long and arduous tour, we were in Turin, and myself and the drummer drank more grappa than was advisable, and then he challenged me to a bout of Icelandic wrestling. This is going to get to the point where I'm going to explain the book behind him.
Okay.
So we got into bout three, and it was a closely fought match. He was considerably younger and more skilled in Icelandic wrestling than me, and he performed a maneuver that ended in me. I tore the tendons in my right knee. So I couldn't go back to the building site after the tour like I usually did. So I'm like, oh shit, I'm going to have this book of poetry. What am I going to do? How am I going to sell poetry to people? Who wants poetry? Not even poets don't want poetry most of the time. So I learned to bookbind from a YouTube video.
Wow.
And then it all progressed from there, really. So now I'm into Japanese stab binding at the moment.
Do you want to elaborate on this craft? What's Japanese stab
Japanese
binding
stab binding. You said, how do I explain that? You drill along the spine. So I make the covers, I lino print and carve the covers, make the book cloth from Kimai. Is this book nerd stuff, right? Nobody wants this.
Honestly, Monocle basically trades on book nerd talks.
So then, yeah, I bind the books, make the end papers myself, print all those off in my kitchen, and then I drill along the spine and then hand sew along the spines.
And is this
spelling and binding, right?
And is this a sort of sustainable business? Are you making a crust out of this?
Do you want to see a book? I've got them in
here. Yeah, that'd be amazing.
Should we get it out now?
Yeah, do it.
Actually, Dan's got them in the other room.
Maybe we can get one brought in. That'd be incredibly
for
helpful.
The people on the radio.
Yeah, exactly.
Have a look
at
this book.
The most visual medium.
As if by magic, a book appears. Spelling and binding. This is a box book, son.
Wow.
Let's see. It's too tight to fit. There you go.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Thank you. It was all my years as a painter and decorator, really, that gave me the skills for it. Can you hear the quality of those pages, listeners?
That is a really lovely object, though, isn't it? I mean, did you have a hand in the art?
I did it all. I designed it.
That's an incredible piece of craft. I'm trying to describe what I'm looking at. It's basically a sort of silver-tinged, quite psychedelic volume, beautifully bound with crazy string. I mean, this is radio, as you said. No one can see it, but I'm looking at something quite impressive.
Crazy string. This is a German embroidery thread. So I get my embroidery thread from a strange little shop where I live in Berlin, and there's two old ladies that work in there. The first time I walked in there looking for embroidery thread, they looked a bit scared. But now we're friends, and they just think I'm funny. So that's nice.
Coming back to the music, a band like Spaceman 3, they did something quite odd, and I get the impression it wasn't too planned out, but it kind of came out in this way, which with hindsight it almost looks like it could have been planned. They made this intensely sort of psychedelic and ramshackle and sort of slightly insane music, but there was almost like a sort of post-ironic irony to some of it, certainly with the titles and stuff like that, like Taking Drugs to Make Music to Take Drugs To. It's like it's just a fantastically sort of circular phrase which means everything and nothing. Do you know what I mean? Was that mm-hmm. something that the band were, even in just a humour way, I guess, were you conscious of like using humour at the time? Or?
There was, I think that band were very serious.
Really?
It was very serious. We took it very seriously.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we had a light-hearted moments, but as far as the music was concerned, it was all very serious. No irony in there.
Well, this is what comes across, so maybe it's all been a huge failure.
You know, I mean, that remains to be seen, doesn't it?
I mean, I'm trying to articulate what I mean. The music itself is beautiful and strange, but I feel like, maybe not an irony, but I feel like there's these nods to pop art and sort of like really bold, almost like branding to it. And then, you know, you had this great logo and stuff like that. It looks like there was a bit of a plan in a way.
Was there a plan? I think the band were very honest about their influences and were bold about the things that they took from the past, and they were not ashamed of that.
Yeah, I think that's what I'm sort of getting at. It's like this sort of like, call it what it is, if you know what I mean.
Well, shouldn't any good music always borrows from the past? Because it's, you know, it's a river, isn't it? Music's a river that's gone back from, you know, the dawn of humanity, when somebody was banging on a rock to your fellow with the sampler nodding along. It's all the same river, isn't it? So what am I getting at here? It's early, isn't it? I'm making any sense here at all? Where do we rock river?
We were talking about whether there was like any plan at all.
A plan. If there was a plan, it was beyond Oz, I think. What was the plan? Just make good music, I think, was only ever the plan. It wasn't like, okay, now we're going to do this, then we're going to sell out this stadium, then we're going to shift this many units, then we're going to... I think everybody was just serious about it and focused, very focused on it.
Yeah.
You know, that was the most important thing, I would say, probably in all of our lives at the time.
We must talk about the copious amounts of drugs.
Copious amounts of
that
drugs.
That were around the band. The title of the book, Playing the Bass with Three Left Hands, kind of alludes to hallucinating while on stage.
Mm.
And I think you said if you do see three left hands, then probably go for the middle one.
Probably. Well, in that particular case, it was the one in the middle that's the real one. But in those situations, it's so hard to know.
If anything, maybe three left hands is actually an advantage because you can play more notes.
Only when you think about it. That was a terrible thing. The more I thought about it, the less I could get them to do any of the hands, the real or the imaginary ones.
Yeah.
The more I thought about them, the less they became willing to do what I thought I wanted them to do. So, yeah, you just have to kind of forget about the three left hands and the fireballs. You just have to focus on the two notes that are stopping making any sense. The more you repeat and repeat and repeat and repeat and repeat them.
Do you think there's something in a musician's mentality which, if you took, say, any other profession, like a data entry analyst or something, and put them on mind-altering drugs, they couldn't do their job, whereas a musician tends to be able to do it, which actually, I mean, you could say, like, oh, well, music's like a sort of more creative, more chilled-out thing, of course they can do it, but actually it's still, like, a really important job, and they still go out on stage and they still do it and they still nail it most of the time.
Mm.
I mean, do you think that maybe CEOs of companies can be learning something from the way a musician's mind operates, just how to be putting, like, very strange influences out of your mind? I mean, it's an important skill to have to get through the day.
I've got to admit, I would like to see Theresa May attempt Question Time on LSD.
Exactly.
I'd like to be asking the questions, though.
I think you might not get the answers you'll ever want.
But that would be great, right? Isn't it boring getting what you want all the time?
It is.
That's the unsurprising fun of bland conformity, right?
Yep. Take acid. Make it interesting.
Honestly, everything in this book, I really don't advise people do it. So a friend of mine was like, shall I give it to my children? I was like, only if it looks like they're
doomed already.
They're wayward. Yeah. They're becoming wayward.
All right. Well, the book is Playing the Bass with Three Left Hands, and the author is Will Carruthers. Best of luck with it, and thanks for talking to us.
Thank you very much, and thanks for having me.
Well, that was Tom Hall speaking to Will Carruthers. And you, well, you're listening to the Monocle Weekly. We'll end with something of a how-to on the weekly this week. Michael Johnson is an award-winning graphic designer and branding expert, and he's the author of the new book, Branding in 5.5 Steps.
And he's well-placed to tell us a thing or two about this mysterious art. Michael's studio, Johnson Banks, is responsible for the look of heavyweight clients that include Virgin Atlantic, the Science Museum, the BFI, and many others. But is branding really as simple as a 5-step formula? Or is there something more intangible, more magical even, to the process? Maybe that's where the elusive half comes in. Well, let's ask the man himself. Michael Johnson, welcome to the Monocle Weekly. Good to have you with us. Is it as simple as 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.5? Or is there always something, intangible, a bit magical, mysterious almost? What do you make of that?
My initial thought about writing this book was that it's very hard to find... It's hard to get some help if you're doing what I do, my day job as I'm a branding guy, and we're a brand consultancy. And every now and again, I would wonder or panic that I was doing it the wrong way. But if you're a marketeer or you're an advertising person, you can go to the bookshelf and you can pull a book off the shelf and it'll be a guide, you know, it'll help you. It'll be a kind of touchstone. And really, there isn't anything in my business that fulfills that function. People tend to be very proprietary about, especially the first half of the process, the strategic stuff. Everyone talks about having their own special model or their own black box, and usually with a little TM at the end, and this is how we do it, and those other guys don't understand it. And that's the first half of the process. The second half of the process, the design process, is sometimes also encased in this kind of magical Hubble bubble about, you know, the design process, and I only get a good idea when I'm running backwards around Hyde Park was. You know what I mean? And so both sides of the process kind of propagate the kind of their own little myths, if you like. And I wanted to kind of slightly burst that bubble.
How long have we had brands, and what is a brand? What's different about a brand to a company?
Well, it's a good question. When I was doing all my research for this book and trying to, if I'd set myself the task of writing a definitive book, I had to get my facts straight and my definition straight, if you like. And what I used to call what I do, I used to call it corporate identity, and people still sometimes talk about that, the end identity of a corporation. And when I first started doing this about 30 years ago, we were trying to persuade people that the notion of corporate identity was broader than just logos and how you painted your plane or what the type you put on your signage. And actually, we always struggled with that, trying to broaden the definition of corporate identity, as we then called it. Even though my old boss, Wally Olins, was very good at talking about personality and things like that, I think we always struggled a little bit. The tipping point seemed to come in the 80s, where people started to talk. In the 90s, where people started to talk more about the branding of an organization, as you started to talk about the emotional connections that people make with organizations. Not just, oh, I like the logo, or I like the font, or I've always loved the red of the Coca-Cola logo, for example, but how they actually felt about it and how they made an emotional connection to that. And that's when you started to see the word branding used. Now, people still say things like brand identity and branding, and it's still a little confusing because it's a young business, really, when you think about it. The whole graphic design consultancy is only post-war, and branding as a notion has only really been the lingua franca for really 15 years, if you like.
I thought what was great in the book at the beginning, you list the reasons why people might come and knock on your door, which includes the need to simplify an organization's ambitions, the need to protect intellectual property, the desire to bring merged companies together. And you suddenly realize there's a huge raft of reasons why branding is not a fluffy process. It's actually vital to the revenue of a business, it looking after its staff, being able to go forward.
Yeah.
So in that strategy bit that you talked about at the beginning of the whole process, is that the kind of gritty conversations you're often having with organizations about, do you intend to carry on? How are you going to do that?
Yeah, and by thank you for pointing that bit out. I was at pains with this book, especially in the first half, to point out that all the strategic reasons why someone would consider branding or rebranding. And also, I'm trying to make it as transparent as possible, demystify as much as possible, put it all out, if you like, open source the whole process in a book. Of course, it may put me out of a job, which I'm hoping it won't. But I'm really hoping that this could be like a kind of a key touchstone. I'm not suggesting it will be the book, but for the first time, really, I'm really trying to put it all in one book and suggest there's a kind of a universal model. And so anyone could read this and get a lot out of it, whether they're a strategist or a designer or a planner or someone on an MBA or, someone who's just on a foundation course.
But it's like, I felt it was a bit like going to the hospital with some kind of bad condition. It kind of laid out what's going to happen to you over the coming months as you go from sickness to hopefully better brand health.
Well, in theory, yes. In theory, yeah.
Michael, I want to ask you a bit about the work you do with clients, not to name names, but how quickly, if you're in a credentials or whatever, you're talking, particularly as Andrew said, about the strategic side of things. Do you know within moments whether you're talking to a client that's going to give you the freedom and is going to get on board with your advice and with your suggestions? Or do you sometimes think, oh no, here we go again? You don't have to name names, but do feel free if you want to. But is it sort of obvious within 2 minutes, this sort of thing?
I wouldn't say 2 minutes, but I think that I suppose working in London, it means that smart clients have got a lot of choice. Most of the time, the people who sit in our boardroom have done quite a lot of research. We're working with Mozilla in California at the moment, and we discovered a little way into the process that they'd started with a list of 65 companies.
that's quite a long list.
That's quite a long list. Yeah. And then asked five of them to have a proper conversation. But my point being really that the business that I work in and also Monocle works in a way, Wink Creative works in, is fairly self-selecting because people have kind of sussed you out generally. The benefit of everyone's corporate brochure being online, i.e. on their websites, is that people can just work out what you do. So it's rare for someone to sit in our boardroom and say, oh, my God, you mean there's strategy involved? oh shit, do we have to wait 6 months before we even start the logo? That is quite rare. But there is still occasions when people do. You can see the penny drop, especially as we start to explain that this stage and this stage and this stage will need a couple of months for each one. And you can see them doing it in their head and thinking, oh my God, we won't do a logo for 6 months, you know. So that is a challenge, yeah, sometimes.
The reason I quizzed you earlier about the difference between a company and a brand, and it's interesting you mentioned Monocle, because I guess we have become a brand, but when we started out...
I think you have.
Yeah. And when we started out the magazine, though, you know, we had conversations about what we believed in, but, you know, what we believed in for journalism and for telling stories and print and honesty and all these things. And they became the basis from which everything else grew.
Yeah, you sort of defined your purpose, whether you meant to do it or not.
Yes. But what I'm intrigued about at the moment is, you know, I've had, you know, two conversations in the past week alone with young companies. I met somebody who's starting a hotel who had been working, it's going to be a big hotel, who's been working on the past year on the brand, and he was telling me about how he was creating the brand story. And then as an aside, as a joke, he said, well, to be honest, it is all made up, but we need a good brand story. And then I spoke to someone the other day who's started another little company. And he said to me, one of the things we really want to stress is, you know, the heritage element of our story. They've been going 12 weeks. Yeah. Now, it feels to me that, you know, sometimes it's like the branding work is done at the very beginning into such a degree. It's like, here's our heritage, here's our story. Mm. And then a company is trying to, you know, wobble on the top of it.
Yeah.
And that's why I wonder sometimes, do you think you need to kind of say sometimes to yourself, okay, the brand needs to be a little bit natural as well. It can't all be made up by an agency or made up on a piece of paper.
Well, in my case, nearly everyone we work with has been in existence for a while, and they have something to say. It's just a question of finding out what it is. So we're very, very rarely just imposing some narrative on top of a good business idea. So we're working in slightly different industries, for example. We're working with lots of not-for-profits and culturals and who have too many stories to tell, if you like, and they're all true. But what we're just trying to find the one that resonates the best with the people that they're either trying to fundraise with or they're trying to a new audience for a museum or whoever it may be.
Because it sounds from the book as though you often have to say to people, okay, let us almost be like archaeologists and come and look at the brand, you know, blow away the dust and find out what the...
There's a lot of that.
The original foundations were, that why you got this going.
Yeah, and that's often the case. I mean, your story is interesting because there is a, not a school of thought really, but there are some critics of the brand narrative aspect of the job in the sense of, well, we're just going to make up a backstory, like you say, we're going to make up a backstory and hold to it. And that is an interesting area. I mean, luckily, it's quite rare that someone will come to us and say, we've got a great idea for a product, can you just write a story for us? Because, that's pretty cynical. And basically, we don't do that. But when I was doing the research for this, I'd realized that some organizations were really exploring authenticity, which is kind of what you were saying. The kind of buzzword has been for a few years now. And I started researching a few companies, looking for something as good examples. So I was looking at both Superdry and Rafa in parallel. Superdry, you may not know, have nothing to do with Japan.
Yes.
Now, you'd be astounded how many people, when they're wearing a Superdry jacket, if you say to them, do you know that was made in Cheltenham? Designed in Cheltenham and you know, made in China. They're just, no one can believe it. I mean, Superdry are going to have a fit when they see the book, but that's their problem. Well, they are. I mean, it's their problem. I'm sorry. We just went in there and we just recorded what we see, you know. And there's this cursory little label inside a jacket that says, you know, something like inspired by Japan, designed in Britain. But as a contrast, I went to see Rafa and the values at the heart of their brand are real. You know, they really are. You know, he goes off and does 100K bike rides, the founder, you know, and they, one of their values is glory through suffering.
I think we can steal that before.
Yeah, and I was a little cynical about it at first, but when I went and met them, and you see all the bike racks in reception, and you know that, you know, something like 8 out of 10 of the employees cycle to work, you know, this kind of shithole industrial state up in the north of London, but they still cycle to work.
Mark, can I ask you about the changes in the last probably what? I guess it's maybe 20 years and digital. People talk about the democratizing process. It's certainly a lot easier for brands to reach a lot more people.
Yeah.
And curious buyers of a brand can find out so much more. You can just go online and you can get all of this information. You can always read, you know, our brand story. Has that made your job easier, or does it make it more difficult? The fact there's so many platforms, there's so much information, does that mean it's harder to sort of control these brand facets, or is it,
yes,
or is,
I mean,
it easier?
Yeah, the control aspect of this stuff is pretty tricky. But what it does do, the corollary of it, is that you need a really clear idea at the core. You need a, why are we here? For most people, you know, why am I here? What am I doing here? It's Monday morning. You know, if the why am I here is to make more money for my boss, then that's not very energetic. You know, it's not energizing. And I think people are starting to see there's a whole almost HR aspect to branding, as well as, you know, how do we sell more fizzy drinks and trainers? So it is quite a challenge, actually. And it's actually only in the last few years that you're even starting to see our purpose or our vision or our values or, you know, what is our brand for? You're starting to see that on websites, and you never saw that before. Mm. Because people, clearly, organizations have to open up now. They have to be more transparent. They have to share who they are and what they do. I think it's good. Yeah, on balance, I think it's good. We're doing a project, you know, in California, where we're doing the entire project in the open. Every stage of the project is being put on a project blog. I mean, people have talked about doing it in the past, but no one's actually done it. So the first narratives, the second narratives, the first design stage, they've all gone up in public. And they've, you know, we've been trolled to the moon and back now. You know, so there was a couple of hundred comments about the kind of brand narratives. And then when the first design, the designs for the Mozilla project that we're doing in the open went up, there were 2,000 comments from the open source community. Because they're an open source software company, producers of the Firefox browser. And they said to us, well, we'd like to do this project in the open. And we went, oh, are you sure?
Did you agonize about that? Or it was quite easy to...
Well, in the original brief, there was a paragraph about this. And, you know, me and my counter-actor, we looked at each other and went, oh, interesting. Because we've done a few projects in the open, but more like we've tracked the way that we've done the project and put it on our blog and people could see it. But in this case, it was in the brief. And then when we were down to the last two, they said, we've got 5 questions for you and the other agency. And 4 of the 5 questions were about doing the project in the open.
Well, the book is called Branding in 5.5 Steps. It's by Michael Johnson. And if you want to start your own brand or maybe disrupt someone else's, I suggest you get a copy. Thank you for joining
Cheers.
Us.
Cheers. Lovely to be here.
Edition 379, Andrew, of the Monocle Weekly. Gone in a flash, just like that.
Just like that. I've loved everyone today, as usual. But Langlands and Bell, we were saying that, you know, you sometimes, you know, you're scared when you realise your depth of knowledge doesn't going to match the guess. But, you know, they speak about their art in such a kind of nice, informal, friendly way. It was like, there was so wonderful to me. I really
well,
enjoyed
and it's it. Interesting because I guess, you know, you go back to that whole, you know, the YBA's movement. There was always this idea that it was very confrontational and very difficult and challenging. But yeah, you couldn't find find a more charming couple of people.
And I hope their work is challenging and is confrontational in some ways, but actually, in person, they just say, really, really great. And a phrase is like, you know, it does take its toll on people, though, because where's Rob Bound? He couldn't track him down today, could we?
I don't know what the word would be. Frozen out by Freeze. He's somewhere on the London art scene.
I think if it was a football match, I think he was stretchered off. He's probably attached to a drip somewhere at this moment, getting a saline solution to return him to normal. So I'm not sure who will be here next week.
It could be. I don't know. 7 days of recovery time might be enough for him. I don't know.
Should we thank the whole crew? Because this is the end of edition 379 of the Monocle Weekly. Today's show was produced by Tom Hall, and it was researched by Himina Menon, and our studio manager was Claire Urban. The Monocle Weekly will be back again next week. But for now, it's goodbye from me, Andrew Tuck.
And from me, Tom Edwards.
Goodbye.